Some of you know I have a theory of Jewish art, which is that it must succeed as art first and Jewishly second. We give a lot of passes to Jewish art, theater, movies, painting, saying, well, it's Jewish, it's good enough. It's kind of like kosher restaurants. They're never, rarely quite good, but because they're kosher, they get this odd pass, good enough for a kosher restaurant. Yeah, exactly. More and more there are great kosher restaurants, but that's not material to this talk. So there is a movie that I think raises excellent theological awareness and is an excellent movie called Ushpizin. It's about the Sukkot holiday and written by and performed by actual Breslov Hasidim. And it's told about the Breslov Hasidic community and a visit that one Hasid gets from his friends from his old secular days who are effectively criminals, and he himself was engaged in some violent behavior. And during my time at Beit Tshuva, at the drug and alcohol rehab in L.A., I had a client who was, he was an early adopter of opioid addiction. He was an early adopter. He had kited checks to pay for pills and falsified and forged prescriptions to get OxyContin and similar things. And he had a lot of rage, which is not uncommon among alcoholics and addicts. A lot of the acting out behaviors stem from places of darkness, from places of pain. And I showed him the movie Ushpizin, which in its climactic scene, the chassid runs to the woods in Jerusalem and prays, Terechem alai, ani lo rotze lichos. God, have mercy on me. I don't want to be angry. Give it up. I don't want to be angry. And Daniel, who was this client whom I'm still in touch with, really caught on to that moment. It became his mantra, his prayer. Thinking about the ways in which anger, rage, and resentment paralyze us, stop us from achieving our potential, get us stuck in one spot where we can't move from. And there is a promise in this week's parasha of the possibility of moving out of anger and resentment. It describes the way the camp was set up with the tabernacle in the middle, surrounded by priests. And in verse 53 of the first chapter, it says, Lo ye ketzef, that wrath, as the King James Bible would probably put it, that wrath and anger would not strike you. Not strike you. This hint, this kernel of a promise that it is possible to let ourselves out of anger. You know, anger is, as they say also in 12-step program, it's like drinking poison and expecting someone else to die. You know, it doesn't, quite often the object of our anger has no idea how angry we are with them. Unless it's your spouse, then you're really, you know, cold shoulder all day long. They probably pretty much get it, but, you know, we're doing it to ourselves. We're holding that rage and those knots in our stomach and that paralysis by ourselves. And some of the reasons that Rashi talks about that verse kind of give us a hint of the reasons we have anger. Rashi says, you shouldn't have anger if you do not keep the mitzvot, nor anger when others do service, when others keep the mitzvot, which suggests one of the reasons we have anger is shame and guilt when we don't achieve. And one of the reasons we have anger is jealousy and resentment when others surpass us. There are many concepts of anger. And anger, I think there are a couple of emotions that really are secondary emotions, like boredom. When a fifth grader says, I'm bored, often what they mean is I'm not challenged, my mind is not stimulated, I'm uncomfortable in this class, I'm not learning enough, I'm learning too much, I'm overwhelmed. Boredom sort of becomes a catch-all. I think anger is like that too. I think anger is often the mask we put over our own grief and sadness and fear and the other dark emotions. When someone threatens us, it's very hard to say, I'm feeling threatened. Most of what we do is respond with anger and resentment and hostility. That's a natural and common human defense mechanism, but the underlying emotions are the difficult ones. So Midrash talks about pieces from this parasha and various verses in Psalms and Ezekiel and Isaiah to compare them, to create an allegory. And I won't give you the derivation of the allegory, but I'll talk about the allegory about the wicked And I think the angry were darkened before the Holy One, before God, and they're brought down to Sheol, which is darkness, which covers them with the deep. Now, Sheol, when I'm asked about Jewish conceptions of the afterlife, the earliest occurs in Genesis and is Sheol, the dark place, the silent place. Rage, those intense and dark emotions, congest us, they freeze us, they put us in darkness, they cover us, they suffocate us. And Rabbi Chizkiah Bar Chaya kind of expands this image. It's like a vat, a clay vat, and you stopper it with a clay stopper. We become encased and enfeebled by our own anger and our own frustrations, our own difficult emotions. Which is not to say that anger doesn't have its place, that resentment isn't a spur for better action. Sometimes jealousy, Ken Brown was telling me that the great musicians, when they hear great musicians, musicians better than themselves, they don't react with jealousy, they react with more practice. They go back to the practice room for another 6 hours when they hear a great musician. That's the ideal. That's the ideal use of jealousy and envy, is to promote yourself to greater heights, but it probably happens about one time in 10. But it is to say that our sages understood the value of dark emotions and the value of anger, righteous rage, for example. They would say in various places, I think it's, who's the gladiator? I'm thinking of dropping his name. The sage who was a gladiator, I'm dropping his name right now. Reish Lakish, thank you, who said that if you don't know how to be angry when there is disgrace against the merciful, you won't know how to be merciful when it comes time to, I'm screwing up the quote, but they're connected. That's it. Thank you. If you're merciful to the cruel, you will be cruel to those in need of mercy, which implies that anger has power. We learn in this parasha that one of the ways that God claims us, that God makes us God's own, that God consecrates us and consecrates the firstborn among us, was by smiting the Egyptian firstborn. Now that's a quirky and difficult theology of might versus right, and it's a theology of midah keneged midah, which is sort of just desserts, but that aside, it implies that action and anger has benefit. And we also hear from another midrash, the reasons that Moses' sons don't succeed him as leaders is there's this concept, it's not even really exactly midrash, it's connected in the Torah, that they weren't part of the Exodus, that they were still in Midian with Moses' father-in-law, that they had not been part of the uprising and the removal and the exodus from Egypt, but they had been kind of cosseted in their training as priests with Yitro. And since they didn't participate in the exodus, they didn't merit the leadership, which is to say that suffering and the things that make us frustrated, that gnaw at us, again, impel us to greater heights, that oysters need sand and grit, that we need frustration, that we need difficulty and challenge to become, to rise up, to be our best selves. But anger, as I mentioned, as I started with, can be paralyzing, and the only prayer we have is Terachem alai, ni lo rotze lichos. I don't want to be angry, God. Have mercy on me. Uplift me from this place of resentment and cruelty and frustration and ignobility. There are a few solutions that are only hinted at in the parasha, mostly through Midrashim about the parasha. So Moses is looking at the Israelite camps, as I noted in my previous teaching. A lot of the parasha is about the standards and the marching orders, sort of the martial order of the troops, how they would arrange left, right, front, and center, which implies eventually military processions and military action. So Moses is organizing the Israelite camp, and he kind of freaks out. He says, oh man, they're going to hate it, because no matter where I place them, they're going to say, you know, I wanted to be on the left. I wanted to be, it's like kids, you know, this is your seat. No, I want to sit over here next to mommy, at least my kids. I think it's true. I think it was an issue when I was growing up, too. So he says, God, what am I supposed to do? And God says, don't worry. They know what they're going to do. They already have precedent for this. When Jacob was dying, he stationed his children around him, both at his death and in the funeral processional. And that was to imitate or to intimate or to precede the marching orders of Bamidbar, of the opening of Numbers. Which suggests to me, anger, you know, worrying and being distressed, they don't always have a place. Sometimes there's no one that really needs to apologize to you, and maybe you're just disappointed. That was something Rabbi Salson pointed out to me about anger. Maybe, you know, it's really just disappointment and not resentment. Maybe you can let it go with a certain amount of fatalism that people aren't perfect, that your job isn't perfect, that life doesn't work out exactly as you would hope, and that God doesn't reveal God's self to you without a little bit of strain. That's a piece. The other piece is sort of a meditation, which is quoted in Pesikta, one of the Midrashic compilations, and by Rabbeinu Bachya. You'll notice it on the insert to your program. That beautiful image, you know, we spend so much of Torah in the wilderness. There's essentially two of the five books are in the wilderness, and maybe Leviticus if you think about it, and towards the end of Exodus. I mean, most of Torah is in wilderness. Bamidbar is the name of the book in the wilderness. But most of Torah is spent not in Ur and Palestine, which would become Israel, is not spent in the Promised Land when they arrive there. In fact, the Torah ends before they arrive. Most of Torah is spent in this empty land. So the Pesikta, the Midrash, says, why do we get Torah in the desert? Why does Torah happen in the desert, and why is Revelation in the desert? And it's to teach us that if a person doesn't surrender himself to God, surrender himself, oneself, herself, like a desert, like an empty land, like a vast and open place, you can't receive the words of the Torah. And to teach us, just as desert is endless, so too is Torah, God's teaching without end. That's not easy. I mean, there's so many things I say to people I counsel, so many things I say in sermons that I'm just saying to remind myself, because so many things are easier said than done, that Zen or Taoist way of accepting the way life is, accepting desert, understanding ourselves as being open to all and evacuated of need and without resistance. It'd be nice. We get moments of that in life. I think as we age, as we grow, we get more and more moments. But life is full of struggle, and it is our nature to resist for good and for bad. It's hard. It's hard to achieve a state of sort of bliss where anger and sadness and frustration, we don't dwell on them, we don't hold them so tight. But not easy. Not easy. Just an ideal. So maybe what we do in the moment is sort of a mindfulness practice. We note our anger, we note our disappointment, we're aware of where we are. Might slow us down in the process of acting out on it. If we can note, I'm feeling angry, I'm feeling something in the pit of my stomach, if we will take a deep breath, step back. Hal taught me something great. He said, if you're in a meeting, and I hope he doesn't mind me repeating this, and you feel upset, you should say, excuse me, I have to go take care of something. the something being yourself. Excuse me, I have to go take care of something. So Nachmanides, the medieval somewhat mystical scholar, says this image is contained. You know, the word we use for the taking of the census is pakad or pakod, which is sort of enrollment, the rolls of the people Israel. But it also comes from the word to notice, to take account of, to attend to. Which is to say, it's a wonderful verb. It's the verb we use to describe God noticing Sarah when God notices that Sarah is barren and promotes her to be fertile. That's what we got to do with our lives. Emulate God. Be mindful. Take notice. Attend to our needs. Attend to the places where we feel frustrated, locked up, paralyzed, encased in that clay, suffering in darkness. And just be where we are. Admit it, maybe to another person, maybe just to ourselves, maybe to God. But to acknowledge, to take notice, we're not perfect. We'll never get to a place of perfect equanimity. Maybe the Dalai Lama. I've heard him speak. He's much more honest about his authenticity and humanity. You know, he struggles too. That's what you have. That's that's really as good as it gets, is just to be in touch.